This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Booz Allen Hamilton is pleased to present a panel discussion titled Advanced Persistent Threat, Industrial Strength Hacking as part of its Expert Voices panel series on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome to the February 3rd, 2011 panel event, Advanced Persistent Threat, Industrial Strength Hacking, part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices Distinguished Speaker Series, sponsored by the Cyber Campaign. It is my pleasure to introduce Bill Stewart, Senior Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton. Bill?
Thank you so much for that introduction. The advanced persistent threat term is one that didn't exist 5 years ago. And based on the excitement around this panel, based on some of my earlier discussions with the panel members before we get started, it's a term that's gained a lot of traction, and it's really become something that is becoming a lexicon within this information security business, and is something that there's a lot of press around. It's out there, out in the open literature. It's in the trade journals. It's really changed the awareness of what's happening within our infrastructures and what's happening and what potentially can happen to us on our networks. So that's a big change, and with any change like that, there's always a lot of uncertainty. And so what we've tried to do is put a panel together today that's going to help us understand what this advanced persistent threat really means, or at least what we think it means today, and more importantly, what kinds of things we can do to respond. There's a lot of energy going into responding to advanced persistent threat today. A lot of money is being spent to do that, and a lot of, I know as a consultant with Booz Allen and Hamilton, a lot of our clients are very interested in understanding how to respond. So a big part of our panel today will be to first understand what it is, and then understand what kinds of things we can do to respond. And, oh, by the way, there's kind of a counter view out there that says the whole thing's overhyped. The whole thing is based on the information security community trying to make more money. So we want to talk about that perspective as well. There's merit to both arguments, as there always is in a debate like this. We're very interested to have that conversation. So what I'd like to do now is introduce our panelists. We have on the phone today Jeffrey Carr. Jeffrey is the author of Inside Cyber Warfare, and he's the Chief Executive Officer of Taiea Global. In a room with me today are several folks. I have Larry Clinton, who's the President of the Internet Security Alliance. Welcome, Larry. Anoop Ghosh, who's the Founder and Chief Scientist for Invincia. Ms. Catherine Lotrionte, who is a professor and associate director with the Georgetown Institute of Law, Science, and Global Security, and also the director of Georgetown's cyber project. And last, and certainly not least, Gary McGraw, who's the chief technology officer of Cigital. This panel really does represent some of the best minds around this topic, and so we're very pleased to bring them here today. As I mentioned earlier, we had some conversation before the panel started. I'm not sure I'm going to need to ask many questions. These folks have strong opinions, and I'm looking forward to a very interesting conversation today. But in order to get things started, I thought I'd start with one question. We're certainly teed up to ask others. And that question is, given that there's lots of noise and lots of literature out there about advanced persistent threat, and given that it doesn't all converge, it doesn't all say the same thing, what I'd like each panel member to do is just give us a brief perspective on what this is, from their perspective, given that, you know, we have a diverse panel here and we're coming at it from many different angles, and then how it's changed and how it's evolved over time. So let's start with Jeffrey on the phone. Jeffrey, could you give us your perspective?
Sure. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the introduction. The advanced persistent threat has unfortunately become as much a marketing term as a descriptor of an attack. However, it certainly is a serious problem. And the best way to define it, in my opinion, is just by looking at some examples for like the Google attack in January of 2010. Google plus maybe 30 other companies is a clear example of advanced persistent threat, and in fact launched the terminology in marketing by a lot of InfoSec companies. Prior to that, the breach of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter was another excellent example of this, which is essentially a stealthy penetration of a network where the adversary continues to gain a foothold no matter how often the network administrators try to stop or repair that breach. It seemingly continues possibly forever. Since it's so hard to actually clean network and know that you've cleaned it. Most recently, of course, Renault has been in the news, a French car company that's literally suing the Chinese government for cyber espionage. Again, we would call this an advanced persistent threat. So I think that's probably the broadest and best way that I can describe it.
Yeah, that was very good. Thank you, Jeffrey. Larry, do you want to add to that?
Sorry, thanks, Gary. From an industry perspective, we take kind of a functional definition of this. So let me start by saying what this is not, because there's this persistent confusion in the general public that what we're talking about are high school kids disrupting systems and trying to get publicity. The recent attacks in the WikiLeaks case on Bank of America, et cetera, these old-style called DOS attacks. Those are some of these disruptive sort of amateur attacks. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about are a series of well-planned, well-organized, well-funded, often state-sponsored attacks using entire suites of designer malware that target not just systems but specific individuals to get at them. These guys are professionals. They're there to steal things. They're more like Tony Soprano and his Chinese partners than they are Ferris Bueller. So that's the sense in which this is an advanced threat. It's also advanced in the sense that they can circumvent virtually all the traditional defenses. Antivirus, et cetera, are basically useless against these guys. What you have to understand is they're going to get into your system. It is in that sense, or one of the senses, that they are persistent. They're coming at you, and they're going to get in. We'll get to it later. This is going to affect how we talk about remediation. Another sense in which this is a persistent threat is not only do they get in, but they stay for dinner. They stay for dinner, they stay for breakfast, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to reside on your system. They're going to reside on your system, and they're not necessarily going to be active the whole time. They'll go quiet so that you think that you've remediated the situation when actually you haven't, and on a periodic basis, they'll call home with new information. They're not interested in taking down your system. They are interested in using your system for a variety of nefarious means.
Thanks, Larry. And I like that analogy of the house guest that won't leave. I have some relatives that I'm going to start thinking of them as advanced persistent threats. Not really, folks. Anoop, can you get me out of trouble here?
Yeah, so, I think Larry did a fine job of defining it. One of the keys that I think a lot of the technologists in the audience get or at least focus on is the technology of the actual exploit itself. And so typically they'll define APT in terms of zero-day exploits, the ability to hide from other AV systems and to bury themselves in the network. But, you know, two key words to understand here is persistent. Persistent means not just that they stay in your network, but actually that they keep coming at you, right? So even if you were able to remove an infection or remediate a network. What you have to understand about APTs is it's a day job for most of these people who are attacking you. They will keep coming back at you. Removing an infection just means you're now targeted, right? And they're very good about targeting individuals, getting users to infect themselves and infect their network. The other part about that, again, is threat, right? So really what we're talking about APTs are people that are coming at you, right? So they're going to continue to go after IP, typically, or they might be interested in planting malware, commercial banking fraud types of malware on your system to steal your identity, potentially do wire fraud from your systems. And then finally, my last comment here is in this community over here, we've typically focused on APTs against government agencies and government systems. The reality is APTs are targeting U.S. Companies, typically in the technology industry, because it's a very cheap and effective way of getting IP that the U.S. has developed, getting them abroad to reduce billions in costs in R&D and jumpstart other efforts abroad.
Thanks, Anoop. That was good, and at this point I'm pretty scared based on those two descriptions. Catherine, is there more to add?
Well, one thing that I would add in describing it to my students and not wanting to use the same words in it, the adversary, first when you talk about the threat, you have to identify the adversary, but it's particularly the exploits that they're using have no known signatures, and that's a significant part of the challenge. They're using exploits with no known signatures to get access. So therefore, firewalls, the antivirus software, is not solving the problem. To solve the problem, we have to think really hard about trying to use defensive measures not based on signatures. So they're either using zero-day exploits or zero-day or past exploits that have been modified. So it takes small changes, and if we're looking for known signatures, we're not going to be able to stop them. So the key is operating under a way for the U.S. defensively where we're not basing everything on signatures, known signatures.
So I think the root cause is what we need to look at. And frankly, a lot of time in computer security has been spent trying to protect the broken stuff from the bad people. And you talked about two examples of that, Catherine. One is a firewall, which everybody knows and loves, and the other is antivirus software, which actually runs on your PC. Unfortunately, neither of those actually work at all. And so the question is, how do we go about really stopping the bad people from getting to the broken stuff? And I think there's an obvious solution, which is stop building broken stuff. So I've been spending the last 15 years trying to get people to make systems that are more secure from the get-go so that we can then make it much harder for the people, the bad people that are going after us with these APTs and zero days and rootkits and stealthy technology makes their job much, much harder, make it much more expensive for them to do.
That was very good. Thank you for that response. And, you know, I think it is interesting how there is this perception around, or not a perception, actually a reality around our current security mechanisms and how difficult it is for those to stop the advanced persistent threat. And what that's leading to is lots of at least reports of loss and damage. What kind of bad things are happening out there? What kind of damage is occurring because we're so vulnerable to these advanced persistent threats?
So I can start with that one. A lot of my customers, I work for a company called Cigital, and we do software security stuff. A lot of our customers are financial services organizations. And from our perspective, the biggest target of APT is the banking system, especially online banking credentials and online banking browsers. I got to tell you that the CIOs at Bank of America think a lot about advanced persistent threats and what happens when their users, who turn out to be their customers, which is rather important if you're a bank, end up getting infected, and then the bad software, the APT, takes their credentials and then masquerades as that customer, as that user. That's really, in my view, the biggest problem. Now, why would criminals go after banks? Well, you know, what did Dillinger say? You go after banks because that's where the money is. And I think that APT goes after the places where the money is, and the money is in banking right now.
That's great, Gary, and I think that's a great analogy around, you know, what they're going after. Larry, do you want to add to that?
I would say two things. I basically agree with a lot of what Gary said, but the money doesn't only exist in banks, okay? And so I think one of the things, and I'd like to circle back to another point where I'll make a distinction that maybe have some controversy with Gary. What we see with the APT is as they get better at their job, and Anup was correct, this is a job to them, as they get better with their job, they branch out. And so not only do they go after banks, they are now going after entire areas of the government. They are going after auto parts shops. And what we are seeing now is what we call vacuum attacks, where they will go in and they will vacuum out the entire business operation of even an auto plant. So, and we think, so they can transfer that knowledge about how to operate a business to Asia, where it can then operate in a competitive mode. So we're seeing now better than half the attacks are against the commercial sector rather than the government sector.
I got a question. Is it all right if I top in?
Well, sure.
Can I just finish the point?
Yeah.
Sure. Because I want to get back to something else you said first.
All right.
So they're expanding it, there's no business that is too small to be attacked. There's no business that's too large to have defenses. They're going to get in, and they're expanding. But the point that I wanted to get back to, Gary, without losing it, is I'm not sure that I see this as a problem of the technology being broken. While I think I agree with some of the substance underneath what you say there, because we need to be expanding the development of the technology, I think that that's the wrong way to think about this. The technology's not broken. Actually, the technology's miraculous if you think about it. The problem is that all the incentives favor the bad guys. These guys are in business to steal things. So it's not that the technology is broken like it was with Y2K, and all we got to do is fix a technical glitch. If we fix a technical glitch, they're going to come after that technical glitch. We have to think of this not as something we're going to fix with a new software or a new set of standards. This is an ongoing war of attrition that is going to involve not just the technology, but the economics, the organizational structures, et cetera. We have to understand that technology now exists throughout our organizations, and we need an organizational-wide approach to combating this threat, not just a technological threat. So I'd probably expand off your thought.
Well, I'm in total agreement with you there, but if you think that the technology's not broken, you're just wrong about that. Unfortunately, the technology is, in fact, broken, and we have to work on that, and we furthermore have to get to users and that are a key part of these systems and get them to be involved in this as well. You know, you said one thing that really, I think, summed it up exactly right. People think of these computers and this technology and all this stuff as magic. And magic is great as long as it's white magic. But as soon as it becomes black magic, and we're talking about defense against the dark arts, you know, let's go Harry Potter on this thing, then what you have is a situation where users, the muggles, don't have a clue about how this stuff works or doesn't work, and the technology people are doing very silly things like asking the user, so, you know, we're about to do a floozy watsit on Sector 4, and there's a hizzly jig there, yes or no? And the user goes, well, I don't know, I was just trying to do something, so yes. And, you know, then you have your problem. As long as it remains magic, and as long as the magic is broken, we are going to have this problem. And frankly, I don't think that we're in as great a shape technologically as you would like to think that we are.
So I'm going to call a truce on this one, and I'm going to agree with both of you because I think you're both right.
Let's get them, Larry.
Yeah. So I'm in trouble. Everybody else is going to have to team with me, I guess. But I think we need holistic solutions. Absolutely, this is a problem that's much broader than technology. But I also think that we need to evolve the technology, and I think that was actually part of Larry's response. So, you know, I agree, and I think it's a big problem, and it needs to be a holistic approach, and I'm hearing that theme from both of you, so I think you're in a more of agreement than you think. And so what I'd like to do now is move to another question around the cost. And the way I'd like to look at this is the cost of not responding. And Larry on the phone, or I'm sorry, Jeffrey on the phone, because Larry's here in the room. Could you give us some thoughts on cost and actually the cost of not responding to APTs?
Yes, and I will, but I have to respond very quickly to what was said earlier by I think it was Gary.
Okay, so no truce, huh?
It's just, yeah.
If you're saying it was wrong, it was Larry.
I completely disagree that banks are representative of APT. Banks are being attacked by Russian organized crime, essentially. There's lots of different ways a bank can be robbed. I think it's very important to distinguish that, something that's done by organized crime, again, something that's done by state-sponsored actors. And APT is it's a much more serious problem regarding theft of intellectual property. And typically that's being done by the People's Republic of China, by the Russian Federation, and other states around the world. The cost of it is enormous. Going back to the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program, that order has been reduced principally because China's anti-aircraft technology has all of a sudden blossomed into something so sophisticated that the lifespan of that fighter has been shortened. So spending $300 million on a plane that's going to be obsolete in 8 years doesn't make sense, and therefore the order's been cut. In other respects, countries are being lured to engage with China for a piece of the market or for joint ventures. We have clients in Australia that are in the mining industry that do joint ventures with China. And so they're partners, right? At the very same time, the Australian government is letting them know that their computers are beaconing data back to China. So it's not even an adversary situation. You can be friends and allies and still have a presence in your system that's drawing out data that results in financial losses to the company that's being attacked.
You know, Jeffrey, I appreciate that answer, and I think that absolutely highlights the cost issue, and it leads me to another question that I'd like to address to Catherine. And Catherine, you know, given that what we're talking about here is trying to live within a cycle of change and respond to change, and your point earlier about the signatures and the fact that, you know, it's they're not known signatures, so it's not an easy look for this pattern and you'll find the bad guy kind of thing. Can we afford to keep up? Can we, you know, is this a realistic expectation or what, you know, is there some other approach to dealing with the cost here?
Well, that takes me back to the question that you wanted to call truce on, and I'm going to have to agree with Gary on this one. Although I'm not technically on the left always, but I can be on the left with you.
You heard it here first.
It is fundamentally a technical problem. There are systems that you can build that will be protected. We could have systems that are protected. I've had many of people tell me, oh, there's no perfectly secure system. Well, I've seen a lot of scientists, really some of the best in the country and the world, demonstrate that that is actually not true, that we can have some really solidly built systems with great technology where this wouldn't happen. So just yesterday, and the second day is today, I'm missing it, I was involved with a war game, cyber war game, with Stratcom. And there was a demonstration, and this in terms of cycles and cost of not responding. The military often sees things in different cycles, and they had this, we talked about this yesterday, about first there's the avoidance, avoid the threat, then you go into the stage of detecting it and watching it, then fighting through it, and then last but not least, surviving, and that's the resiliency part. Well, when we're thinking about cyber, we have spent a lot of time in the detecting stage, and that's what we've been doing. We're watching. I mean, DHS is rolling out a very expensive way to watch the threats as they come in. And now most of the literature and people are talking about the resilience. We now need to learn how to survive when the enemy is in our systems. And what we need to focus on, because the cost is astronomical, is to stop. We need to get out of those cycles back to the avoid. The way to avoid is to build these systems in a different way. And it means educating not the end user, because please, the end user is not the problem. You're not going to go and say, I'm going to incentivize my great-grandmother in Wisconsin to use the patches. That is absolutely ridiculous. It is to educate, and the role of the government, is to educate the CEOs. Yeah. And the CISOs, but the CEOs are fundamental to that too, of these companies. So it is fundamentally a technical problem that we do have to fix.
Yeah. Catherine, that was a great answer, and just to try and pull the truce together here, or the coalition. I think what you said actually aligns with what I was hearing from both. Larry and Jeffrey, and a point you made around building systems that are much harder to get into, I absolutely agree with. I think there's technology out there that we haven't deployed for lots of different reasons, and I think part of it has been cost. It's expensive, but the question is that more expensive given what we're doing now on the back end to try and root these folks out when they're in our systems? Anoop, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I'd actually like to pick up where Catherine left off. We've got, if you look at the technologies we deploy today in the enterprise, they were actually developed in the mid to late 90s, and we haven't seen a lot of technical progress in defending our networks as much as we've seen innovation in the adversarial side, right? So if you think back to the late 90s, we had signature-based defenses, we had firewalls, and we had IDSs, right? And that's essentially where we are today. In the meantime, the adversaries have completely figured out that it's a complete blacklist-based approach, which is in order to defend against a network, you have to know the threat ahead of time, right? And so on the adversarial side, they figured out ways to automatically produce vast numbers of variants of malware. So today, there's about 60,000 new variants of malware every day, right? So any blacklist-based approach or signature-based approach is not going to be able to keep up, not going to be able to scale with that. So to Catherine's point, there are technologies today that have been developed. And a slight counter to Gary, just to be on the other side of Gary for once, is we can't depend on software manufacturers to write perfect software. It's not going to happen in our lifetime, right? We need to do better. We need to do better in our software development education and in our software development processes to build better software. But fundamentally, our architectures are susceptible to this problem of requiring perfection, right? So if you think about how our computers work, we have millions of lines of code and something called a browser, right, that's connecting our trusted desktop and our trusted network to this untrusted cloud called the Internet, right? And when there's a single flaw in any of that browser code or any of the extensions in that browser code, that flaw gets exploited. Sometimes it's exploiting the user on the end of that browser who says, hey, do you want to install this plugin? And as Gary said, sure, if I get to see some interesting content, I'm going to click yes. And at that point, I've infected my system, right? So from a technology point of view, we know we're not going to fix the user, and we're not going to create perfect software. So what can we do? Well, we can design resilient architectures, said in a different way, which is separate the untrusted code and separate user actions from the security of that system, right? So we've got strong technologies today, like virtualization technology, where we can separate these concerns. We can allow users to see the content that they want to see, to go on Facebook without infecting their desktop. We just have to have the will to deploy these technologies in the enterprise and in the home.
Thanks, Anoop. That was a great answer, and I agree. There's an architectural change that's necessary to help us here. So, as I predicted, this panel is very lively, and so I'm gonna we'll keep pulling the thread here. I know Larry wants to get in, and Gary. So let's go to Larry first.
Well, I think you're right, Bill. I don't think we really do disagree. When I was responding to you, Gary, what I was trying to say is, if we just think of this as a technology problem, we're not going to get the solution. Clearly, there's a technological component to it. No one would argue with that. What I was trying to say, though, is that And this is very similar to what Catherine was saying. The problem is not that we don't know how to build good technology. The problem is more that we won't buy good technology. And so just as Catherine said, and this is what the ISA has been advocating for a period of years, we need to elevate this out of just the technologists and include the CEOs. Mm-hmm. In fact, we advocate that the CFO in organizations ought to be the person who's managing cybersecurity, because that, for a variety of reasons we won't even go into here because that gets off on a tangent. But that's the point. We have to address this not just as a technological problem, but also as a strategic and economic problem. And historically, we have looked at this solely as an operational, technical issue, and that's the wrong approach. To get back to the issue of cost, though, you're exactly right in the premise of your question. Combating the APT now, and by the way, it can be combated. For example, Jeff mentioned the Google attacks. There are organizations who were able to withstand the Google attacks, got attacked like Google, and were able to manage it. There are sophisticated mechanisms, a lot of which are in the literature, that can be used. But the problem is that most organizations can't afford that. We're going to need to evolve not only new technological and economic structures, but new organizational structures, because the elites are currently just talking to the elites. Booz Allen talks to Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We need to expand that out. We need to develop an information sharing mechanism wherein the elites share with the elites, but we come out with a passive mechanism so that people don't have to make the sort of silly decisions that Gary was articulating. Instead, they operate it like they do their AV system now, where they just get a notice, say, push this button, block this website, and then you're going to be, we have to make this so that the elites are carrying the cost and then transferring that out to the non-elites who can, in a cost-efficient and passive manner, protect their systems. Because the entire network, the whole system, the network of networks, needs to be protected. We can't siphon this off into a set of straws, and a lot of that gets back to the economics.
Larry, some very good points there, and I like the analogy of cost, and I agree with you around the issue of doing some cost sharing, and we're very very pleased that you put Booz Allen in the elite category. Now the question is, to your point, and I think some of your point was technology transfer, and more than technology, it's methods, it's policies, it's a lot of things need to transfer broadly, because we're all in this together, we're all in one network, which is part of the problem. So how do we do that? How do we create, number one, the technology? How do we make the investments? Who makes the investments? And then how do we get it out there in a way that causes the systems to be more secure on the front end?
So, Bill,
Gary,
well,
how about Jeff on the phone, and then we'll go to Gary.
Yeah, I have to object to this. There is not a technological solution to this. The only thing that improved technology will do is raise the bar, but there is no height to a bar that will keep an advanced persistent threat adversary away. It doesn't matter if you're using virtualization. It doesn't matter if you're using encryption. The best encryption researchers in the world are in one university in China. One professor and four graduate students have cracked 5 of the world's 10 best encryption algorithms. Virtualization, one of the best companies in the country that does virtualization is Parallels, which is a Russian company. But it doesn't. So the problem here is does not have a technological solution. The bottom line is that there are multiple vectors. You can enter a system through the hardware. There's malware that's being developed that targets the chip and completely ignores the software. Even if all of that were removed, you still have the human factor. You can still target the CEO of a company who is probably completely unaware of the nitty-gritty elements of his IT security program, and gain access to a system through a highly visible individual. There's just so many ways in that you never think of all of the different ways to defend your key resources. So the solution to this can certainly be partly done by raising the bar technologically, but there must be a low-tech solution as well. which is changing the way that we protect our data and identifying the data that we don't have to worry about with the very critical data that we do have to worry about, and you focus your protection there through real-time monitoring. I just wanted to make that such an important factor that keeps getting ignored, because there's little money, there's little profit in low-tech solutions, and most of the big players are invested in high-tech solutions. So I think it's a key element of the conversation.
Jeffrey, no, I hear your point, and you know, I think you're right. The systems that are out there today are there are an enormous number of ways to get in, and there's lots of vulnerabilities. And I also agree that raising the bar will help, but it's not the final answer. And I think to your point, some of the monitoring is when you look around at what some of the emerging trends are, you see that. And so I think, you know, you're definitely highlighting a potential part of at least a near-term solution. The question is, you know, what happens when you pull the thread on the monitoring? And while it's low-tech, you need people in the loop, and you need systems in the loop that do cost money. So it's an interesting trade, and I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think you're making a very good point. So Gary's been trying to break in here for quite some time, so I'll let him respond.
So I have a new can of worms to open. I think it's fine to talk about advanced persistent threat, but I think what we've ended up talking about today is this huge mishmash of cybercrime, cyber espionage, and in some sense, cyber war, although nobody's brought up the war part. Now, you know, when you're talking about the espionage that happened at Google or the examples that Larry's bringing up, which are important examples, or you're talking about cybercrime, where we have the Russians going after internet banking stuff and the Zeus Trojan, those are the targets, and those are not what advanced persistent threat is. It's not about the targets per se. Really, in my view, advanced persistent threat is about the approach. It's about the weapon system, if you will, that are being used to both carry out industrial espionage by the Chinese and also cybercrime by the Russian mob and the Nigerians. And I think that if we want to talk about APT, we sort of limit ourselves to talking about a technological problem, a weapon system, and why that system exists and what it's targeting from a technical perspective. On the other hand, if we want to talk about cybercrime and cyber espionage, and then later even cyber war, which is what the government seems to be all wound around the axle about these days, we have to change the conversation and start talking about what Larry said and also what Jeffrey said on the phone. This is not just a pure technical solution. We've got to get our policies in place. We have to get CEOs to buy the right stuff. There should be incentives for people to build the right kind of systems. It has to be at least as cheap economically to build a secure system as to build a piece of crap. And today, things aren't really set up that way. So I think that though it's interesting to tease those three things apart, crime, war, and espionage, that really, in the end, we can solve all three systems with the same approach. And I'm going to go back to the notion of building secure systems. By the way, Jeffrey, I agree with you that it's not just software that has to be built properly, but I think that's a majority of the problem today. Most of the hardware that is created today is compiled out of software, and you know, even the BIOS is a bunch of software. These hugely advanced targets, technological approaches to getting your advanced persistent threat to get your target taken care of in the first place, to root your box, so to speak, and then to stay around forever, are a direct result of the fact that our systems are riddled with holes, both from an architectural perspective and from a manufacturing perspective, and if you want to get xenophobic, from a we let anybody build any part of our systems we want perspective.
So, you know, as I said before, I'm even more scared now. But, you know, I think what we're painting a picture here of lots of things that need to happen to solve this problem. And one of the takeaways that I'm picking up from the panel is that we definitely need a team approach, if you will. And we need sectors to come together that may not have come together around this problem as much as they need to get the solutions. And we're looking at, you know, how to make that happen, or what we're looking at now is the impact of that not happening. And so, Catherine, you know, how do we get the government, you know, our allies, civil and commercial sectors to come to the table with the solutions that we need to work together to help us survive together on the network?
So there has been a lot of talk about a public-private partnership between the government and the private sector. And for the most part, I'm not quite sure what people mean when they say that.
Political pandering is what they mean.
Yeah, and some are very cynical, like Gary is, about what that is. I'll put that, I won't describe what I think it means, but something in that category. But there is, so aside from just calling it public-private, clearly, unlike some past threats, particularly kind of thinking about the counterterrorism issue, this type of threat requires more than in the past some cooperative collaboration between private and the government. Now, what does that mean, though, specifically? And that's what most people should kind of more be more focused on. In practice, what does it mean? Well, my view is that it can't mean that the government takes over everything. That is a very controversial point that's very sensitive domestically, particularly among private sector. The government can, though, do quite a lot with respect to education. Educating, particularly, I would target the CEOs. I would agree with Larry, the CFOs, as well as the computer security folks at companies. Fundamentally, one of the reasons why the government can't take over is our legal system. Unless we're going to radically change the way our country runs as a democracy, including the Bill of Rights and the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment, there are limits to what the government can do vis-a-vis computer security. And here I'm mainly focusing on the protecting of the critical infrastructure, which is what is controversial, Einstein and DHS, Einstein 3, you know, future. So there are limits to what the government can do, but they can do a lot. The private companies that I've talked to in this partnership sharing information, clearly there has to be more sharing of information. But the government's got to sit down and be more giving with its information so the private companies see the benefit, the business benefit. And we're not talking about indemnification or tax subsidies. It's information that will actually help the company gain more profits. So the government's got to sort through its concerns about doing that, picking companies potentially, and how they would do that. But that would incentivize the private companies to then share that. Internationally, we do need more of the collaboration, some maybe consensus on standardizing rules such as the notification breach laws. I think a lot more work needs to be done there, and some countries are ahead of us in that. And also norms of behavior in terms of rules of engagement by state actors, the norm of state responsibility. So governments can do a lot, but not everything.
Yeah, excellent point. And I think in our society, that is, you know, that's the way we set up the government, and we did it for a reason, and it seems to work. So, I agree with you, but it does seem like there are some relationships and partnerships and things that we need to make happen that we're just not there yet with. One area that comes to mind that would align with some of our earlier discussions would be an area of research. And how do we take some of this good knowledge that I think is out there that the folks on the panel know about, that is in the government, and how do we get that out into the commercial sector and get it out to the places where it can have an impact and raise the bar for everybody? Anoop, I know you've spent some time in that community. Do you want to take that on?
Sure. Glad to. So, my earlier comments, I said the technology we have deployed in our networks today was really developed in the mid-90s. The government has invested substantially in research and development in cybersecurity since that time period. What has not happened is translation of that research into the commercial sector. And incidentally, the government acquires all of its IT from the commercial sector. right? It's not acquiring IT from government contractors, and it's not acquiring IT from universities and researchers, right? So if you're the federal government, you're buying your IT from Microsoft, sometimes Apple, Cisco, Juniper, et cetera. What we haven't seen on the government side, we've seen significant investment in R&D, but what we haven't seen is the buying power applied towards innovation, right? So we know that the technologies today, and the government is aware, the technologies today they're deploying are not up to the threat because they have very good intel on the level of the threat that's out there. What's interesting is we all know examples of R&D that can address this threat. You know, now, to Jeffrey's point earlier, there is no silver bullet solution in the technology sector, period. No one on the panel is going to say there is. But what we have today is a state of affairs where our adversaries have open access to our networks. And what we need to do, what we can do technology-wise with the will and the buying power on the government side is to demand more secure systems so we can put ourselves on an equal footing with our adversaries, right? And so going back to an earlier question on cost, what's the cost of not addressing this issue, right? So one of the key points in the President's State of the Union speech was global economic competitiveness, right? This is a key area, cyber, where we are losing our global economic competitiveness because we are not exerting the influence to buy innovation that's come out of R&D sectors in the U.S. to bring them to market, to deploy them in government systems. And as a result, we're falling behind not only on the security side, but also on the tech side, losing IP to our adversaries.
Thanks, Anoop. That was good. And I know we have a couple of folks that want to respond. Larry, do you want to add a response quickly?
Yeah, I'd like to quickly tie in the last two comments. I think one of the problems we've had with government R&D is that it has been too focused on operational military sorts of solutions and not kind of the basic research that we really need to do. But since we have very little time, I want to go back to Catherine's point in terms of what the government's role ought to be here. And while everybody's in favor of education, frankly, that's not where I think the big issue has to be addressed here from the government perspective. We have to fundamentally rethink how we're doing this. The system of perimeter defense, which is what we have basically operated in as a model, does not work with respect to the APT. The idea that we're going to find the vulnerabilities in the system and patch the system and keep them out, that doesn't work. We have to instead understand that the guys are getting into the system through the APT, and what we have to do is stop them getting back out of the system. And one way to do this is to block the command and control sites that they do, the websites and the URLs, change the model of information sharing, and we will get more information shared. And quickly to the core problem of what government needs to do, government needs to change the incentive model. The reason that the technology-only solutions won't work, as I think Jeffrey pointed out, is that they're going to keep coming back to us. That's what persistent means. And the reason they keep coming back to us is all the incentives with respect to cybersecurity favor the bad guys. Attacks are cheap, they're easy, they're profitable, your chances of getting caught are minimal. On the defense side, the perimeter defend is infinite. It's impossible to demonstrate return on investment, and we're inherently a generation behind the attacker. So long as that's the economic equation, we're never going to solve the problem. We have to change the incentive structure.
Very good points, and you know, hard to disagree with them. I like the idea of looking at the APTs as kind of untrusted insiders that you have to deal with, and building your security around that. Okay, so we're going to wrap things up now, and I'm going to give everybody one last shot. And I'm going to pose a question, and you can answer the question or not. But my question is, what's the single most important thing we should do to respond here? And let's start with Gary.
So I could just pull a Gorbachev and say whatever I want for as long as I want, and that would be the end of the panel.
It would be, but we wouldn't be happy with that.
Just point that out. I have a story about light at the end of the tunnel and about how we're making some serious progress in computer security. I'm actually optimistic about the progress we've made in the last decade. And I think a lot of that progress is in my own field of software security. And the story has to do with a guy who used to run the lab at Sigital. He's sitting right over there. who got a DARPA grant to work on scanning source code for vulnerabilities, which we then took further with an advanced technology ATP program thing over the Valley of Death and created a technology that was ready for prime time. They got licensed to Kleiner Perkins. They got turned into a company called Fortify that just got bought by HP and is now going wide in the world. The notion of the government investing properly in research and development is a very good one. And we really screwed that up in the last decade. I think we're getting back on the horse, but you can't just stop doing science for 10 years like we did in this country. We have got to invest in the future, and we have to invest in the scientific future. I think we have some very good examples of how that works and how that moves our field forward, because we have to move our field forward, or else we're just going to lose the advantage, and cyber's the way that we'll lose it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gorbachev. We are just about out of time. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap things up.
Yes.
But I want to thank all our panelists. And as promised, it was a very good discussion, very lively. And thanks to all of you. And again, we have with us today Jeffrey Carr, who's the author of Inside Cyber Warfare and a chief executive officer of Taiya Global. Larry Clinton, president of the Internet Security Alliance, Anoop Ghosh, founder and chief scientist of Invincia, Ms. Catherine Letrionti, who's the professor of associate director at Georgetown's Institute of Law, Science, and Global Security, and the director of Georgetown's Cyber Project, and Mr. Gary McGraw, who's the chief technology officer of Cigital. And I am Bill Stewart, senior vice president of Booz Allen Hamilton. Thanks so much for participating today in our panel.
Thank you for listening to Booz Allen Hamilton's panel discussion titled Advanced Persistent Threat, Industrial Strength Hacking on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.